This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who's not here tonight because I'm in Palmerston North. I'm in the office of Dr. Mike Joy, who's a senior lecturer in ecology and zoology in the Institute of Agriculture and Environment at Massey University. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming.
Interesting institute name.
Yes. I think it was just we were in science and we were doing our science, and then we had to kind of join up with somebody, and they thought that agriculture was a logical, and probably is a logical connection. And I think it's probably a good mix. Most of the graduates, well, most of the undergraduates want to do agriculture and environmental science. It is a great combination. It is the future. So
let's take a few steps back. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Christchurch. I was born in Nelson. Then when I was just a baby, my parents moved to Christchurch and I grew up there, went to school there until I was about 15. We moved to Wellington and so finished off schooling in Wellington.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be a policeman. My dad was a policeman, and I think I wanted to be a policeman. But then, that changed, and I had so many different careers. You know, I didn't come to university until I was 33, so I'd done, you know, heaps of different things before that.
What did you do before that?
I started out dairy farming, actually. It was the first job that I had. Mm-hmm. And then I built boats and sailed in the Pacific and travelled around Australia and built a house and... I drove taxis, drove trucks. You know, it was the day when you could just walk from one job to the next kind of thing when you were sick of that one. There was another one down the road, you know. And you know, when I compare wages and or what I could buy in those days, then, you know, they were great. They were, you know, times were different. You know, you were young and you could just change jobs and have plenty of money.
And what led you to university then?
It was kind of the end of that era, I guess. It was... you know, the time when you couldn't walk from job to job, and I'd sort of had an interest in science and fresh water, and then the opportunity came along for my partner and I both to she was keen on studying as well, and we had a friend who had a house in Bulls of all places that he bought for next to nothing that we could live in for next to nothing, and so then we, you know, that made us. So it was basically 10 years at university from that point on. You know.
Interest in science and fresh water from way back. Mm. Where did that come from?
Oh, I was thinking about that. I think it was our picnics, school trips. They weren't anything like they are now. And once a year we got to go to Coe's Ford on the Selwyn River in Christchurch. And I remember, you know, just spending hours mucking around, catching little fish and things. But... I mean, that was the recreation in Christchurch. We never went to beaches much. We went to the rivers and we swam in rivers. So I guess I always had that connection to rivers. And that kind of a time where we honestly, and we were probably correct in believing that we lived in this amazing, you know, country, this clean, green New Zealand, where we were so much better off than anyone else in the world. And you could just go swimming anywhere and our rivers were clean. Well, in comparison to how they are now, they were clean, yeah.
And you said you came to do science?
Yeah, so I guess science had interested me, and it was through my undergrad that I got, kind of inspired by the guy who turned out to be my co-supervisor, Russell Death, and which has caused a lot of hilarity and that we publish papers together, joy and death, and death and joy papers are, you know, always cause a bit of fun.
What did he do that was so inspiring?
I guess that it was just the, you know, the realisation of how much, you know, freshwater was changing in New Zealand, and just how interesting and different our rivers and the life in them, these amazing native fish that we have that are 80% endemic, so, you know, just a whole other world that really interested me.
Are they, perhaps, were they special?
Oh, they are, yeah, and sadly, they're really special now because we have the highest proportion of threatened freshwater fish species of any country in the world. So special and amazing, but, you know, like the rest of our fauna, you know, like a lot of it, they're cryptic. You know, you don't see them so easily. Most people don't know we even have them. And so, you know, that was part of the interest to me. And then as I worked through that, the realization also that more and more of them were becoming threatened species, and yet we have this bizarre situation where they're threatened species, but we commercially harvest them and we eat them. So, you know, most New Zealanders don't realise that when they eat a whitebait fritter, that they're eating threatened species, and it kind of doesn't fit with the New Zealand way. You know, we get all upset about the Japanese whaling and you know, people shooting tigers and killing other threatened species, but for some reason, we maybe because we don't know that we harvest them here and we export them and sell our threatened species to other countries, and yet we are signatories to a TRAN on a treaty that bans trade in endangered species.
But a whitebait doesn't have the same mana as Cecil.
No, unfortunately it doesn't, and that's the trouble. Yeah.
So what did you do your undergrad in?
Yes, so I did ecology, mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I did a BSc in ecology, and then I did a master's in ecology as well, and that was really on native freshwater fish, looking at the impacts of dams on them, mostly in Taranaki, and got some funding from DOC to fund that master's, and I did really well, published four papers out of my master's thesis, and that kind of set me up for a really good PhD, a well-funded PhD. And, you know, so I had a fantastic 3 years of summers in the field, you know, travelling around the country fishing for native fish, and winters writing it up. And I kind of look back on that time, you know, it's just the best time of my life. The contrast now is that I do about 100 things really badly, whereas then I did one thing really well, you know.
So what was the PhD on?
Oh, so the PhD was basically using biomonitoring, but it was especially using fish as a measure of the health of waterways. So I ended up getting into predictive modelling, and bizarrely for me, as someone, you know, a real Luddite when it came to computers, because they just weren't around in my younger days, I got into modelling using artificial neural networks and big time meta analysis, where I was running them on multiple computers and things like that. So I have this kind of nerdy side to my research that I do miss now, because I don't get to do that much of it. But you know, it's I'd say I'm probably the world's worst mathematician, but the modelling side of it, that data mining and stuff, is I found it much more artistic. It's probably closer to that, sort of looking for patterns in nature, fitted more with my style of thinking than you know, any kind of mathematics. So, you know, did some reasonably groundbreaking work using artificial intelligence and modelling, and published that internationally and went to international conferences and that kind of thing.
So can we use fish as an indicator of the health of waterways?
Yeah, we can, and we do, yeah. Most of the regional councils in New Zealand now use my models, and I'm upgrading them, just doing one for Auckland Council at the moment. So, you know, they're still going, and I'm still doing that kind of stuff.
Is it particular fish, or is it
proportional? No, it's all fish, you try and measure all of the fish there, and it's just kind of comparing what should be there with what is there, and, you know, sort of coming up with a score as the health of the river. And they kind of... they much more integrate the whole river than you. I mean, you can take chemical samples from a river, take snapshots, and they're pretty meaningless, really, because things change so much naturally in rivers.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas because our fish live up to 100 years, and then they tell you, you know, over much longer time periods, and they're, of course, dependent on everything that happens in and around the river. So they are probably the best measure of the health of an ecosystem.
Is there not some long lag for recovery, though?
Yeah, there is. I mean, that's all part of it as well. There is, and the other interesting situation is that they're mostly national populations and that they have some phase in the seawater. Most of our fish are amphidromous, which means that the adults live in freshwater and they breed every year, but their juveniles go out to sea and there they mix together. So you can have, you know, you can have the best habitats, a few of the really good habitats like Fiordland and places like that, but the fish will still disappear because they're reliant on a whole national population. So you can't just save one or two habitats. To save those species, you've got to save, you know, most of the rivers rather than a few of the rivers.
Okay. And that thinking at that national scale, we're not very good at.
No, we're not. No, that's for sure. No. We're very regionalised in our responses to what's going on. And you know that you can quite clearly see some of the maps that I've made and Niwa make on the distribution of the fish and the invertebrates that are their food. Really clear patterns in relation to land use. So intensive farming, the lowland rivers and intensively farmed areas. So pretty much look at the map, it's Southland, Canterbury, Manawatu, Taranaki, Hawke's Bay, Waikato, really, really bad, you know, and that's where the bad stuff happens.
We don't have many lowland forests.
No, nothing much left. No, that's part of the issue. Lowland forests and wetlands. Yeah.
The water as well.
Yeah. So the places where you see the really healthy fish communities are, you know, Stewart Island, Fiordland, some of South Westland, a little bit of Nelson, you know, anywhere where there's a conservation land that gets close to the sea is where we still have, you know, really healthy rivers.
How big does a reserve area have to be?
It's got to be the whole catchment, basically.
Right.
Yeah. This is what's happened is that because they're mostly migratory, most of the fish species are found closer to the sea. But that happens to be the area where we've done most of the damage. So we have some, you know, most of the conservation estate is up in high country. So very few of the species can get up there. So it's all very well that we have perfect habitats up there. You know, that's great for if you're a tourist or a skier or something like that. But it's no good if you're a native fish in New Zealand because you have to get there somehow. And if the bottom ends had it, that's where the problems are for them. You know, it's worse. It's just unfortunate. It's what saved them, I guess, from, you know, from natural disasters. Things like, the whole country being under the water, you know, going back over 100,000 years for us freshwater fish, of course, you know, salt water's not too good. So, but having that life space and being able to live in salt water protects you from that and from big, you know, things like the Taupo eruption and things that would have wiped out all of the fish. You still have some reserves in the ocean, so you can repopulate after things, you know, disasters like that happen, natural or otherwise. But then, so that's the upside of the natural part of it, but the downside of that is that all of the degradation is in the lower parts of the rivers, so the best habitats are the least available and the worst habitats are the most available to them. So it's kind of everything adding up to being bad news for native fish.
What point in your career did you perhaps the light bulb come on that there's something wrong?
Oh, okay, you know, I kind of had it, you know, there was lots of signs, but I think when it
really... Because when you were a kid, you're swimming in the river.
Yeah. No, it was, I think when it really hit me, wasn't until into my PhD, when I started going back to sites that I'd been to before, and even just in a year or two, I could see these massive changes happening. So it was, and then, you know, doing lots of surveys in lowland areas like the Manawatu, and just day after day going out there keen and fired up and coming, it just... nothing there all the time, or those same old fish that can handle, the really tolerant ones that can handle the rubbish, you know, then they're just finding them. So is that just that, that heartbreak of going out there and seeing these degraded habitats wherever you go kind of thing? Yeah.
Is there an equivalent in the fish world of the spread of buttercups and dandelions?
Yeah, we do have invasive species that are spreading through, and I guess it's probably the same, you know, with a lot of weed spread. It's because we change in a really pristine New Zealand river, these invasive species wouldn't do well at all. It's because we changed our lakes and rivers to be much more like the kind of lowland degraded, well, eutrophic, you know, highly nutrient-enriched habitats that a lot of these fish came from, that we make it like that. So, you know, the sort of Asian situation where the koi carp and things come from, we're turning our habitats into that. So it's an indication of the decline, is that these invasive species do well.
You were saying that you were going out and seeing the changes. Was that only when you were doing the fishing, or could you get to a river and know?
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, yeah, after. When you've been doing this for a while, you become like the predictive model, the computer. I mean, you're kind of doing that. You're doing that same thing. You're taking in, and you know pretty much what you're going to be find. Yeah, and so it's not, I guess that's one of the things that's hard for people to understand, is that there's not just one bad thing that happens. It's a cumulative effect. It's death by a thousand cuts. And so wherever you go, it's not just the forest that's being cut down. It's, you know, and the cows and the river. It's a combination of multiple impacts that accumulate down rivers. That's the thing with rivers, you know, that all of the impacts just pile up. Everything that happens on the land, eventually gravity takes it down to the river, and that's when the problems
start.
That's
what we like about rivers, they take our problem.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's the Victorian way of looking at it. They're just a handy way of chucking our rubbish and it all disappears. Magic, gone. But, you know, I mean, I remember in my undergrad here, we had a chemistry lecturer who used to, you know, rant about the solution to pollution is dilution. You know, and that's such an old dinosaur view of the world, and now that we dominate the planet, then we can see that dilution isn't the reality. It doesn't just go away, it accumulates somewhere. And so, you know, what I'm telling my students is the solution to pollution is assimilation. And if the ecosystem can't assimilate it, then you've got to stop putting it in there, kind of thing. And so, you know, we have to rethink all of that stuff, and it changes so quickly. You know, I guess that a lot of lecturers and universities can to some extent recycle a lot of their work, you know, year after year. The physics equation doesn't change and the chemistry equation doesn't change, but the environmental science, you know, this kind of stuff that I'm dealing with, you know, it's virtually rewrite the lecture every year because something amazing has happened and changed in that time that we never could have predicted.
Some of these things are the consequences. In fact, all of these things that we're doing are the consequences of us trying to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked about the pollution and we've talked about the land degradation. Some of it is purposeful with flood control.
Yeah. Although a lot of the flood control happens because, you know, partly because we want to live next to rivers, but a lot of the flood issues that happen, for example, in the Manawatū, are the result of stupid land use changes that we did in the 70s. You know, there's massive amounts of sediment that came down these rivers from government-subsidised, you know, bush clearance, where you had sheep retention schemes and farmers were clearing bush off steep country because that was their only income, because they were subsidised to do that. And so now we pay the price, and it's a huge price that we pay now and stop banking and flood control. You have the Manawatū River higher than the surrounding lowlands, and so you have to have flat, you know, if they're big high levees to keep the river in there. But then when the river comes up, it would just, if you didn't have flap gates on those river junctions, then the water would flow back up the rivers and into the, you know, plains. And so you have to have these flaps then you have to pump the rivers into it, you know, the tributaries have to be pumped into the main river. Massive engineering feats that just to kind of do what a river would do for nothing for you if you hadn't messed with it in the first place, kind of thing, you know. And that's so often the story. you know, it costs us so much more to do what nature would have done for us for nothing. And I've got some really good examples from, you know, my favourite one is we're creating, regional councils are creating wetlands now, making artificial wetlands and putting them in lakes and around the edges of lakes to take up nutrients. Incredibly expensive. But at the same time, other councils, or sometimes the same council, is consenting the draining of wetlands. So they will allow someone to destroy a wetland while they'll pay hundreds of thousands of dollars, or millions of dollars in the case of the Rotorua Lakes, to create the wetlands. And, you know, of course, it's so stupid, but under our economic system, they're both good for GDP. So, yeah.
We've got to give the engineers something to do.
Yes, right. So we can... It's great for business that we can create these wetlands. But in the example of the Rotorua Lakes, and this is where the Dairy New Zealand's done, it's 37 times cheaper not to do it. So you take to get a tonne of nitrogen out of the lake costs a minimum of $240,000. So you create this floating wetland. You know, it's basically plants just floating on a little island. They take up the nutrients. You have to then cut it and take it away and maybe compost it or do whatever you're going to do. Whereas if you went to the farm and you put a ton less nitrogen on that farm, and this is at the old milk price when it was really high, the loss of revenue is $6,600 for one ton versus $240,000 to get it out of the lake. And plus, you know, one is a private loss and the other one is a public loss, you know, so the public are paying for the cleanup and the farmers, you know, and it's not, I'm not trying to blame the farmers here. They just respond to the legislation. They're business people like anyone else. They have debts, they have banks breathing down their necks and that kind of thing. It's the legislators, it's the decision makers that have failed.
The farmers think you're trying to blame the farmers.
Yeah, some of them do, but I think that a lot of them, you know, federated farmers, which are the extremists and don't represent that many farmers at all, are pretty anti. But, well, there's the example of Landcorp that I'm on that environmental reference group with Landcorp, our biggest farmer, and they are keen on that, and they don't see me like that at all, and they're looking for solutions and realise there's a problem. The trouble is that the farming group that gets most of the media coverage is this extreme, you know, group that really, really doesn't represent, you know, numerically or in any way the average New Zealand farmer.
So you said about halfway through your PhD you started to think that things were going wrong. You were busily publishing at the time.
Yeah.
At what point did you realise that you had intentionally or perhaps not stuck your head above the parapet?
Well, I realised that, you know, I was publishing these papers that were getting well cited in ecological informatics and journals like that that are read by maybe, you know, I mean, I'd hate to put a number on it, probably half a dozen nerds like me that read them and work in that area, and that I could write those things forever. And all I would end up doing is just cataloguing the decline of the species, so I wasn't going to do that. So the first time I wrote an op-ed article, I realised that, you know, from the response from that, the huge response from an op-ed article in the Herald or the Don Post, you know, that was far more important. Because I believe, and it's possibly, probably naively, that the only way that this will change is if the public are aware of what's going on. And they're never going to know what's in journals, scientific journals, but they do read op-ed articles. You know, I mean, that the famous one was the op-ed article in the Herald about our clean green image that ended up being the thing that John Key was challenged on the BBC Hard Talk program. You know, that Hard Talk would never have picked that up from anywhere, you know, from a scientific journal, but they did pick it up from an online, you know, op-ed in the Herald.
More recently, in New Zealand's freshwater disaster.
Yeah,
in fact,
yeah,
you're using
yeah.
disaster yeah, in a technical paper.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's quite a big call to do that.
Yeah, no, but I think if you look at the facts, there's no way you could call it anything else other than a disaster. You know, that, you know, if you go through the statistics, and then you realise that that's not an exaggeration in any way. And in fact, it's probably, you know, it's quite moderate language compared to where we are.
The 100% pure articles and the journal, the thing that, that got the attention in that sense. And at the same time, you wrote Our Sacred Cows.
Yeah.
And looking at the percentages at risk and things. Mm-hmm. And they're pretty scary percentages of all the different, you know, the vascular plants, the reptiles and so on.
Yeah.
These are big numbers that are either extinct or at risk. So you say that we need to get this into the public attention.
Mm-hmm.
What's been the effect of that?
It's really, really hard to measure, of course, isn't it? But I think there's a lot more awareness, certainly, you know, and I can't say it's due to me, but, I mean, all of the surveys that are done, Lincoln University every second year does a survey of people's awareness of environmental issues, and you can just see that fresh water just coming up to being the most important from nothing to the most important. Horizons of Research just did one for Fish and Game, and their public awareness around freshwater issues is massive now, and people really do see that and climate change as the major, you know, issues for our future. So I think that, and so I think inevitably that has to influence the decision makers. Although having said that, there's obviously a huge amount more lobbying power that the industry has to get to the decision makers, because I haven't seen, at the same time as the public awareness going up, I haven't seen any improvement in the decisions that they're making.
Is it still getting worse?
Yeah, it's definitely getting worse, and we've had a big back down on the protection as well. And it's this, if you could sort of characterise what's happening with freshwater, is that more and more money and more and more effort goes into public relations and communication staff and making things sound good, and hidden underneath all that is the reality that things are actually getting worse, and that the protections are being weakened rather than strengthened.
But don't people claim that the number of rivers that we can drink the water from are getting better?
No, yeah, that's the thing. They claim it, but there's no fact to that at all. There's no improvement. There's a couple of rivers. There's no net improvement. A couple of rivers that they've taken point source discharges out of. You know, it's things like pipes, you know, meatworks and things like that. So there's been an improvement there, but at the same time, there's been a net worsening. So, it's, you know, if you think about that, you forget drinking water, because most of the rivers you can't drink from, but when it comes to swimming, now 62% of all of the length of all of our rivers are unsafe to swim in. And there's a really good example. And so what the government response to that has been is to shift from having a standard called contact recreation to a separate one, you know, so that there was a Ministry of Health guideline there at contact recreation, and that's to protect you from getting sick if you get some water in your mouth when you're swimming, and that's 260 coliform units per litre. Now it's 1,000, and they call it wadeable. So you know, that's that kind of back down from 260 to now 1,000 being allowed, and you're safe if you're in a boat or you've got waders on, is the new norm. You know, that's the kind of...
mean it's not actively toxic?
Yeah, well, no, it means that, yeah, you're safe to go in there if you're in a boat, but you're not safe to swim in there anymore. You know, but they just backed away and they just shifted the goalposts like that. And that's... And so then they can go, well, look, you know, you go from a map that's mostly red to a map that's green, and it's okay to go, you know. So it's just... It's just completely...
But why would they do that?
Would be quite simply because if they showed, you know, if people were told that 62% of all our rivers are unswimmable, then that would be a kickback. So you just, you know, it's just typical, just shift the baseline. They did the same thing, well, they've done it with a whole lot of things, but with nitrogen, you go from a protection of 0.5 milligram of nitrogen, which is, you know, considered the goal, and they've shifted it to 6.9 milliliters. So, you know, my analogy is saying that you're going to, you know, do something about road safety and shift the speed limit from 50 kilometers an hour to 690 kilometers an hour, and somehow at the same time, you know, con the country that this is a fresh start for fresh water. You know, that's it's this is it's wrong in so many ways, but this is the new reality of freshwater management.
But why would they want to do that? No one's.
Well, no, it's not. They want to do it.
They're not making money out of having this higher.
No. But it's the reality is that the rivers in New Zealand already exceed that. So that was how. This is how it was done: was to just get a whole lot of scientists to produce these maps of where the problems were, and then somebody in government look at it and go, well, you know, this is going to try and clean this up is huge. We'd have to change everything that we're doing. So what we'll do is just shift the goalposts instead. And so then how it is now becomes the baseline. And then, you know, we'll try to work to maintain or improve at that level.
You costed it this year $15
billion. Yeah, so that was the cost to clean up the impacts of dairy. Yeah, so the... So, you know, that was the upper end of it. So the dairy brings in $15 billion worth of income. If you had to pay for their cleanup, then it would be at least $15 billion if that's cleaning up the water and just the direct pollution from that industry. And we couldn't measure a whole lot of things, but that was just the handful of things that we did have numbers for. It easily cancelled out what it was supposedly worth to the country. So these are the externalities. The reality is, and the industries will be, you know, first to tell you this, that if you did that for almost every industry, that you'd find that if you had to pay the cost of the cleanup, then it would be more than what it purports to make. And so that's the reality that we've covered that up, we've sat on it for generations, but it's all coming home, you know, now that we have to face up to that reality because we are having to pay the price now.
The massive growth in dairying over the last few years,
yeah.
Is there a direct consequential effect on the waterways?
Yeah, that's been the major driver. I mean, that's why it appears that I'm picking on dairy, but it's a kind of a triage situation where you just look at, you've got to start with the biggest, and that is the biggest. And it's the reason it's the biggest problem is that it's become unsustainable. It's so dependent on external inputs, and so I mean the really big one to think about is nitrogen, because that's the one that's causing, you know, arguably most of the problems in the river, depending on where you are. We used to go back 30-40 years, nitrogen came from clover in the paddocks that fixed atmospheric nitrogen and put it into the soil, made it available to the plants. Now we use fossil fuels to make it, so Maui gas field plus a third comes from there, the rest comes from the Middle East. So all of this, and it's, you know, somewhere around 800% increase over the last 20 years, all coming from fossil fuels. Just think about how unsustainable it is to make milk out of fossil fuels, which is pretty much what we're doing. Only worse than that, because it's not going out in the milk, it's mostly going out in our rivers and destroying our rivers and our offshore you know, oceans as well, and estuaries and things. And it's, and okay, so you can look at that as a national issue, but internationally, some work that's been done recently on the how much the planet can handle has shown that these planetary boundaries are exceeded by sevenfold when it comes to global nitrogen use. So we're one part of that whole sad, unfortunate reality that we got tied up into feeding this massive population by using energy that was stored over millennia. And so it you know, really means we're going to have to face a, you know, we're already way past what the earth can handle.
You say you're not picking on dairy.
Mm.
It's just that it's the biggest, but
yeah.
Per, I don't know how you want to measure it, per cow or per unit of milk or something, is it proportionately bad?
Yeah, well, if you try and think of it human equivalent, so at the one cow's waste is equivalent to at least 14 humans, you know, up to 40 depending on what you're looking at. But if we stick to 14 and go conservative, then the impact on our waterways and is equivalent to having a population of 90 million people, except that 90 million people, humans mostly their waste is processed to some extent in a wastewater treatment plant, whereas what's happening on the land, most of that urine is going is ending up in fresh water. So, you know, you think that we're underpopulated at 4.5 million people, but if you just counted the dairy cows, just the dairy cows alone, there'd be an equivalent of 90 million. So, you know, that it kind of puts it into balance that, sure, there's human impacts, you know, from cities and all that kind of thing, but it's tiny in comparison to just the dairy cows.
But these farms are green and outside. We can get away with calling them 100% pure.
Yeah, that's the issue, isn't it? That you can't see what the problem is. You know, that's always been the problem. If people could see this, you know, bright red river or something like that. I mean, there's been a lot of publicity around some lakes in Waikato recently that have turned red with algal blooms, and a massive response to it when the problem isn't, you know, that big, but because you can see it. I liken, you know, like I use in my talks and things, it's like an industrial town turned upside down. So if you imagine, you know, sort of Victorian England with the industrial, you know, all these chimneys pumping out smoke and the issues that came from that, flip it upside down. It's the nutrients that leak out the bottom of our farms through the soil that are the problems. But you don't see them. If they were smoke coming over us, then we would all be so aware of it. But because it just goes down and through our waters, then we don't see it, and there's far less public awareness of it. And so then it's only in summer when they go swimming and get sick, or they go for a swim and there's no water in the river, or it's all slimy and green and smelly and they don't want to go there. That's when it hits home to people.
We were on holiday in South Canterbury a couple of years ago, and yeah, we couldn't find a swimming hole.
No, you wouldn't. Yeah,
there was no water.
Right. There's no water, yeah. No, that's the sad thing, and that's when it hits home to New Zealanders, is that, yeah. But we thought, you know, now we're told it's aspirational. I mean, that was the thing that shocked me one day, to wake up and turn on national radio and hear John Key say that swimming in our rivers is aspirational. And for someone to tell you that something that you take for granted and think is part of being a New Zealander is suddenly aspirational. Well, you wonder what will be next. Will breathing without, you know, respirators be aspirational? You know, that's a slippery slope. And, you know, you've got to draw the line somewhere.
But our country needs these dairy farmers, does it not?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because it's from the individual dairy farmer's point of view. They make more money with less cows, and this can be shown in so many situations. But I mean, the example that I use, and I've got a book coming out. I use this example in my talk in the book that's going to be coming out in November, with Bridget Williams' books, one of their texts. You take a farm, and this is you know, a good representation of a real live farm that's near here, that's running 620 cows at the moment. And if you remove 100 cows, then you'll make 100,000 more profit. And this is at the high milk price. You actually keep taking cows away from that farm, and gradually the profit drops back down again. But the point where you were at the profit level for the 620 cows, when you get back to that, it's 380 cows. So you can make the same amount of money with 380 cows as you can with 620, because there's so many less inputs going in there. And, you know, what's really important is there's about a third of the pollution that there was at 620 cows. It's not a linear thing. You don't halve the number of cows and halve the pollution. You weigh more than half the pollution when you get rid of that many cows. So from an individual farmer's profit point of view, then they're losing money by overstocking. But they're being driven by the industry to maximise production, not maximising profit. So we, you know, and I'm not the only one saying this, but and many farm economists are saying this, that you could probably get rid of a third of the cows in this country and farmers would be more profitable. You know, of course, Fonterra wouldn't have the same turnover. You wouldn't have the same GDP. You'd have a hell of a lot less pollution, like way more than a third less pollution, and farmers would be better off. The trouble is that what's driving that maximisation is this: the fact that most of the money made on farms is made in capital gains, not in milk profits. So you maximize your land value by your production per hectare, not by your profitability, you know. And then it's not funny. You can see the reality of biological limits for the whole country, and that while production has increased over the last 10 years, well, you know, over the last 30 years, but if you look at the last 10 years, productivity has not increased. In fact, it's dipped, because this is a natural biological limit. I mean, if we were making, I don't know, clothes pegs, and you make more clothes pegs as long as you've got a market, there's a straight line increase in your, you know, in your production and your productivity. They match each other and your profits go up at the same rate. But in a biological system, you meet natural boundaries. And so you keep chucking more stuff on, you have more cows and more nutrients going in there, more palm kernel to feed them, but you don't increase productivity at that same rate. And so it flattens off. And if you look for the whole country, it's actually dipping now. That's why there's a kind of a disconnect. There's a drive towards maximising production, but not maximising profit.
And we as a society pride ourselves on the fact that we have disconnected ourselves from those biological limits. Different houses, not caves.
Yeah. Which is wrong, because I mean, we still are totally dependent on, you know, not just swimming in rivers, but having clean water and all that kind of thing. You look at Auckland now, gets a large chunk of its water from Waikato River, just as an example. Now the Waikato River is way more polluted every year from nutrients, and so you get the drinking plant having to spend more and more money to clean the river to make the water drinkable. You know, this is an example of, you know, the millions that get spent in especially regions like here in Canterbury on flood control and that kind of thing. There is a huge cost being paid here, but it's being borne by someone else. And so, and you've got an industry that's having major impacts, but they're not paying the costs of the cleanup. So you're having these, you know, taxpayer-funded cleanup funds, like $300-odd million going into the Rotorua Lakes to clean up a mess, you know, that's still being made. Yeah, this is, and it's kind of a frustrating thing too, that you talk about cleaning up a mess, but you don't clean up anything while you're still making the mess, you know. So, but again, it's good PR for governments and local government to say that they're cleaning up.
Clearly, we need to have some socio-ecological transformation. Can you see a pathway to a positive outcome?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when it comes to what we're doing with the land here, then obviously adding value, and organics, the price for organic milk is about five times what it is for non-organic milk. I'm not going to call it conventional, because it's not conventional. This is a trap that people fall into when they say conventional farming. What we're doing now is not conventional farming. It's very unconventional. It's industrial farming. So, but if you look at organic or you know, you can call it anything you like, but basically sustainable farming, backing off from intensity and thinking about soil health and animal health and pasture health and all that kind of thing, biological farming, then the profits are much, much higher. So you have, you know, there's a premium. At the moment, what we're doing is we're going for this commodity market. So we're making the cheapest possible product, this milk powder that just goes off into, you know, mostly into Asia and actually mostly replaces breast milk. So that, you know, it's not even like it's feeding lots of people. But if you're in this commodity market and the competition globally is to make the cheapest possible product, then you're competing against other countries to have the weakest environmental laws, the weakest labour laws. You know, basically you're just trying to make the cheapest possible product. So that's a race that we don't want to be in. You know, you don't want to win that race, and that's the race we've been in. We're no longer the cheapest producer of milk by a long shot. So we can't win on that cheapness. You know, even though we're trying to weaken labour laws by more than half of the workers on dairy farms coming from countries with weaker labour laws like the Philippines and stuff, where they'll put up with much worse conditions than New Zealand as well. We've got weakening of environmental laws to try and you know, catch that cheap market. So it's just a bad place to be. We need to go the other way, and and maximise, you know, value by ensuring that we, you know, that people will pay a premium for high quality food that's sustainably farmed. And in the longer term, the bigger picture is that animals have to come out of human food. You know, more than half of the greenhouse gas emissions in New Zealand and globally come from animal agriculture. If you look at the energy transfer, it's so inefficient through animals that to be able to feed, if we get anywhere near 8 billion people on this planet, then animals will have to come out of the food chain, and we have to start eating plants, because that, you know, the conversion, energy conversion to protein is so much more efficient eating plants than it is having an animal as a middleman.
It all sounds very sensible to me. But can you understand why your views were described as economic sabotage?
Yeah, because if you have a very short-term narrow view of economics, then you think that all you're going to live for is your next election, then sure, then, you know, but it doesn't change the fact that in the long term, everybody will pay so much more. We're already putting huge costs on future generations. It's just because the economists that say that kind of thing don't measure the reality. They just measure GDP. They don't measure what the costs are and what's not being paid by an industry. And you'll always get those people because they're winning in the system, you know, by pushing their costs off onto other people. So they're bound to say that.
What's the biggest success you've had in the last few years?
I don't think that I can really think of any one thing. I guess I'm pretty excited about this, being on this team with Landcorp, so this environmental reference group, and I've pretty much given up on government, central or local, you know, to do anything here. The only way we're going to get anywhere is for industry to lead the way. And Landcorp's our biggest farmer, and if Landcorp can do it right and show other farmers, you know, that you can make money and look after the land and the waterways, then that's my hope, that's where we'll see the change.
There's always been the organic farmers in the mix. They've always been there. Why is farming allowed itself to get convinced by this commodity maximisation thing?
Because they're not paying the true cost of, you know, so it's always going to be cheaper to say palm kernel is a really good example, you know, because there's really lax environmental protection overseas, and so there's this cheap, you know, byproduct of a really disgusting process that's happening overseas, and it gets here cheap because it's backloaded on the ships that take our logs away, our unprocessed logs away. Again, another whole story that we could get into. So they're backloading, they're coming back to get loads of logs, so they'll bring palm kernel back, and so it's cheap to get here, cheap to use, so you throw it at the cows and you feed the cows. Nobody doing it properly can compete with that. You know, you'll never be able to compete the same as, you know, photovoltaic panels or wind farms can't compete with oil that's really cheap, because you're only paying the price of getting it out of the ground, not the real price of it. So in this unfair system, then you know, the doing things right can't win. But eventually it does, you know. Like eventually, when reality hits, then the milk price drops like it has now. Then all of the guys that are, you know, that are organic are laughing now, because they're getting paid so much more than the industrial ones.
You said that you don't have much hope for local and national government, but if we were to have a change of government to a government that decided that they wanted to fix this, what would it have to do?
It would have to you know, put a price on the externalities. And it's, I mean, we talk about this market economy. We supposedly have a market economy. So if we had a market economy, then the costs would have to be borne by the people by the organisations that are making the impacts. And so, I mean, I've come up with a really simple model, just as an example. Every farmer in New Zealand has a has to use the software called Overseer, which calculates how much nitrogen they lose. So they know how much nitrogen, they know how much they're polluting, they know how much milk they're producing. So you just divide the production by the loss of nitrogen, because that's what's costing. Break all the farmers in New Zealand up into three. The top third, the most efficient third, that are leaching the least, and they get paid a premium. You don't even, you can take, then the middle third you don't do anything with. The bottom third, you take a dollar per kilogram off them to pay the top third. That way it's fiscally neutral, but you're always, and you don't set those boundaries and leave them there. Every year you recalculate them so that you're always driving for the most efficiency. So you pay a premium to the good ones, and you take it away from the bad ones, and that way you would drive change in the positive direction. Really, really simple stuff, you know. The trouble is, right now, almost every farmer in New Zealand, dairy farmer, is losing money. So to try and impose even more costs on them would be suicide. So, you know, it's something that has to be done when and if it comes right, you know.
And as we've seen with trying to impose health and safety legislation, they're pretty powerful.
That's right. Yeah, you're up against that, and they're their own worst enemies in a way, you know. And you'll find it's the feds and the extremists that are driving, you know, that kind of thing.
Do you talk to mild-mannered farmers that get it?
Oh, totally. Yeah, I suspect they're probably numerically dominant, but they don't. Most of them don't have anything to do with federated farmers, and so if we just don't hear from them, that's the thing, you know.
What motivates you?
A sense of injustice and anger. You know, I see this as a social justice issue as much as anything, and that a small group get to take away something that belongs to all of us and profit from it. You know, that comes back to that whole, you know, being able to swim in our rivers kind of thing. So there's that, and what gets me out of bed in the morning is anger. You know, every time I turn on the radio and I hear some more rubbish, you know, and more cover-ups, then it makes me more driven to want to get the truth out to people, you know.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Yeah, I am an activist, yeah. And I think that's the end of all my talks that I've been giving lately, including to bunches of school kids and things, is that's our price for, that's the price we have to pay. This is a quote from Alice Walker, that our price for living on this planet is to be active. You know, we can't sit back anymore. And if we sit back and think that someone else is going to fix it for us, then we're doomed. We have to all become active to change this. Yeah, so pretty big powers, you know, economically powerful people that are doing very well out of this, and it's hard work to take them on, so we all have to be active to do that.
And it's okay being an activist and an academic?
I think it's part of my job. I have a role under the Education Act to be the critic and conscience of society. It's harder and harder all the time for universities to have that role, because we're told we need to bring in more external funding. Huge amount of the funding that comes into this university and this institute comes from fertilizer companies, for example. And so, you know, it's obviously a tricky situation to have somebody within this university who's saying we need to stop using these things.
Are they publicly questioning that?
Alan
Mark's autobiography lays out some quite intense lobbying
I don't know how much goes on. I mean, I don't know what happens. I do know from the Vice-Chancellor that federated farmers have regularly called for me to be sacked, you know, ringing him up and telling him, and other people doing that. So, you know, that's the great thing about a university. I'm still here.
You're still bringing your lunch.
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, it's crucial for society that we have the ability to be able to speak out like this. And I see that being really undermined. And you know, a number of other people are talking about this as well. But while I still can, I'll keep fighting.
What's the biggest challenge you've got in the next couple of years?
I guess it's just trying to get change, really, you know, trying to show the way. I want to envisage and maybe get a bunch of people together to write a book or something like that to show the alternative New Zealand, let people see. There is a much, much brighter future than this. You know, it's like with all these things, you get portrayed as a Luddite if you say, or you want to go backwards. But the reality is that the sustainable world would be so much more fun and so much more exciting than the dirty world and that we're in at the moment. But trying to portray that is a real challenge, I think.
Especially when the cheerleaders for the maximising extractive world use the term brighter future.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they're very good at the PR stuff. And they have, again, that because they have all the money, then they can employ and use all the right things. But I really feel, and I feel really positive after just having done a tour of schools and talked to year 13s, that there is a generation coming through that really do get it. And they know that they'll spend the rest of their lives trying to clean up the mess that we've left for them. And they're ready for that challenge. And we have to support them and motivate them to be able to do that, so the future is a lot brighter than just going down this path to destruction.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur, what would that be?
It would be having a government that actually came up with legislation that was for the people and not for a few. And when it came to the environment, that would mean prioritising environmental protection over the profits of a few individuals.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
I think that, you know, what you can do individually, the biggest, the most effect you can have as an individual is to try and take animal agriculture out of your diet, as far as greenhouse gas emissions and water use and all those kind of things go. So that's your individual choice, but that's not enough. You have to be active and you have to stand up for your future and your children's future, which means stopping this destruction.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.